This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When it comes to human happiness, the ancients were under no illusions. The gate is narrow and the way is hard, says the Bible. And without the gods on your side, thought the ancient Greeks, the search was hopeless. By the time of the Enlightenment and the American Declaration of Independence, the active pursuit of happiness was described as a right. By our time, in the era of self-help bookstores, feel-good gurus, and the Prozac Nation, happiness itself is often seen as a right, and anything less a ripoff. The ancients would have laughed. Up next on Point, a history of happiness, and what the happiness of other times and people can tell us about our own. Joining us is Darren McMahon, professor of history at Florida State University and author of the new book, Happiness, A History. Professor McMahon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Good to be here, Tom, and hello, Mr. McMahon.
Darren McMahon, this is a heck of a book. I didn't know what to think going in, but it's quite a history. Cultural, intellectual, gets right down to the nub of things. I mean, it's a huge sweep. Where do you begin here?
Well, I begin actually with Greek tragedy, which may seem a sort of depressing place to begin, but I do so because I want to illustrate the major transformation that takes place after Greek tragedy. Anyone who's ever read a work by Sophocles or Aeschylus or Euripides, one of the great tragic playwrights, will know that things don't usually work out well. There are no happy endings in Greek tragedy. And that's indicative of a wider cultural feeling about happiness. Happiness is something that the gods have and that humans might have if we're fortunate, but it's not something we can control. And indeed, the kind of moral lesson of a tragic universe is that usually when we try to control things or when we try to pursue things, the gods do things to slip us up.
You give us a tremendous vantage on the way we think about happiness these days. I mean, as you say, in the year 2006, there's this promise, the expectation, the allure of happiness all around us. And the way we see it is not as people have always seen it. I wish you'd share this terrific story with us of Croesus and Solon, the rich king and the philosopher, their meeting and interaction around happiness, these millennia ago.
Sure. Herodotus is usually considered the first historian in the Western tradition, and this is a story from his history. What's interesting is that Herodotus was a contemporary and probably a friend of Sophocles, the tragic playwright. So the tale of Croesus is, in fact, a tragic tale, and I begin the book with it. Croesus is the richest man in the world. And he believes that he's the happiest man of the world, but he wants this confirmed by one of the wisest men in the world, Solon, who's a lawgiver from Athens and who's traveled over much of the world in search of knowledge. And Croesus brings him to his court, and he asks him who the happiest man in the world is, expecting that he will say Croesus.
Right.
And Solon doesn't give him the right answer. He tells him that, in fact, Tellus, an Athenian who was killed in battle at the prime of life, is the happiest man, and two others, Cleobus and Biton, who also die at a young age, are the second and third happiest. Well, Croesus says, you know, this guy's an idiot. Get out of my palace. He sends him on his way, and lo and behold, bad things start to happen. His son is killed in a freak accident. He misinterprets an oracle, bringing Persian armies into him. His kingdom is destroyed, and he finds himself on top of a funeral pyre, crying out to the gods, "Call no man happy until he is dead." And this is the wisdom that Solon tried to impart to him.
On a funeral pile, being burned alive, Croesus
exactly.
Finds himself, and suddenly thinks back to Solon, saying, "No one who lives is happy."
Exactly. And Solon's lesson to him was that, you know, Croesus, things are going well for you right now, but human life is long and the world is uncertain and the gods are whimsical. We can't say at this point how your life will turn out. And Solon ends up to be right, of course.
And at that moment, when Croesus comes to that kind of tragic insight, as he stands on the burning funeral pyre, the skies open, the rains come down, the fire is quenched. He's saved, but he never goes back into the world thinking or assuming
that he'll be happy. Yet today, these thousands of years later, what's your sense, Darren McMahon, of what people, or at least Americans, assume about happiness?
Sure. Well, we've come an awful long way. I do like to point out that there's still an element of this tragic understanding of happiness, though, embedded in the very words we use. Happiness is an old English, an old Norse term, and the root of it is hap, which means luck or fortune. And in fact, this is true of every word for happiness in every Indo-European language. They're all cognate with luck or fortune, which harkens back to this older tragic notion of the world as something we can't control. But as I say, we've come so far since then, and I think increasingly since the 18th century, we assume that happiness is not only something we can attain in life, but that we ought to attain, that we really should attain by virtue of being human. And this puts a good deal of pressure on us. And one of the things I try to argue in the book is that although it's liberating to some degree, it puts this pressure on us and creates its own sort of unhappiness, the unhappiness of not being happy when we don't attain what we desire.
Jack, we're genuinely happy to have you with us share your perspective here in this sweep of history. I mean, on the one hand, we look at the Enlightenment, the American Declaration of Independence, and all that came after. We want to be liberated to be happy. We want to think that we can have happiness. Why should we be cut off permanently from that? And yet it can seem kind of thin, kind of facile next to the ancients' view that Darren McMahon lays out here.
Yes, and he's got a page pretty much of titles of books about how to be happy. It fills a whole page.
Off of contemporary bookstore shelves.
That's right, that's right. And, you know, it seems to me, Mr. McMahon, you really show the journey is from fate to fate. We go from the ancients and their view of fortuna and circumstance to the genes, where
Absolutely.
You know you quote a psychologist saying nearly 100% of the variation across people in the happiness set point seems to be due to individual differences in genetic makeup, that we're sort of destined inwardly and from our ancestors. This is where we began.
Darren McMahon?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful kind of return, although the point I'll make right after that is we won't accept fate, clearly. We live in a world that won't accept the potential unfairness of the genetic lottery. And so therefore, I think that opens the door for thinking about genetic manipulation or psychopharmacological means to attaining happiness if we can't get it on our own.
Darren, take us back, if you would, through this kind of march of understanding of happiness. It helps illuminate how we see it today. Right from the Greeks forward, what are some of the high points you look at, the definitions that you're citing here?
Sure. Well, the first major turning point I see occurs about the end of the 5th century B.C. With the advent of the philosophy of Socrates, as recorded in his student Plato's works, and then carried on by Aristotle and others. And what Socrates seems to have said is that, look, every human being wants happiness. That's clear. Let's figure out how to get it. And this is a critical shift. What Socrates does is send philosophy in pursuit of human happiness, rejecting this older tragic notion that we should simply be the minions of fate or the gods. Socrates believes in the possibility, at least, of attaining happiness through living a virtuous life. And this is Plato's and then Aristotle's point very centrally, that if we can control human virtues, we can control our destiny.
So living a virtuous life, I guess as we go, we want to contrast this to how you see the pursuit of happiness today. Is that at the heart of the contemporary pursuit of happiness?
Well, I don't think so, although I think that the idea of virtue dies hard. It's still around in the 18th century when people begin to posit that human happiness ought to be a kind of natural, something natural to human beings. But they tend in the 18th century already to think of happiness more in terms of pleasure and pain. Maximizing pleasure, minimizing pain is the road to happiness. And I would argue that in many respects we've carried on that notion, that when you ask somebody today how to express happiness, they'll say, well, good feeling, right? Having a smile on one's face. For the ancients, happiness was measured over the whole course of a life, and it didn't necessarily have to do with good feeling. It had more to do with how one lived one's life in keeping with virtue over the course of an entire life.
The great watershed you describe as the Enlightenment. How so?
Well, we've got, of course, this long intervening period in which, in the Western tradition at least, Christianity has ascended. And the Christian tradition has very interesting things to say about happiness, and it's complicated. But at the most simple level, there is a notion that that because of original sin, because of our transgression in the Garden of Eden, human beings are destined to a kind of constant restlessness in this world that will pursue happiness without success. This is a point that's elaborated mm-hmm. in great detail by St. Augustine, for example. Mm. And that happiness, if it comes at all, will come in the next life when we're rejoined to God, if we're so fortunate. What Enlightenment thinkers, beginning in the latter part of the 17th century and into the 18th century, start to say is that, first of all, human beings don't come into the world congenitally marred by original sin, that the world is ours to make, and that human reason is a strong force, and we indeed have control over our lives, that we shouldn't have to apologize for pleasure enjoying the world. And moreover, this is something that we should work to encourage. The emphasis is increasingly on this world, then, rather than the next world, and this opens space for thinking about attaining human happiness in this life.
Darren McMahon, you really, in many ways, tell us a philosopher's tale here. I mean, you look at happiness through the eyes of philosophers. I wish you'd take us to some of the high points between Socrates and today, the perspectives of those thinkers trying to figure all this out. Take us on the short course that will give us the kind of the peaks in the mountain range there.
Sure. Greatest hits of Western philosophy.
Well, on the point of happiness anyway.
Absolutely. Well, there are many of them, and one person I like to point to is Martin Luther, the Protestant leader of the Reformation, because he reorients things in really interesting ways. If happiness in the previous Christian conception doesn't occur until the next life, and we want to emulate the Savior, want to emulate Christ, then many people had reasoned that a certain sort of suffering can in fact lead to salvation. And so people in the Middle Ages wear the hair shirt, right, and mm-hmm. Put themselves through these kind of ascetic gymnastics in denying themselves. And Luther himself did this. But he comes to the realization that there's not a whole lot he can do through his own action without God's grace, and that the key is just to accept God on faith and look for signs of that grace. Well, he takes this a little farther, and he says, our unhappiness is in fact a sign of our sin. And he has this wonderful phrase, tristitia omnis a satana, all sadness is from Satan. And then reasons that if we're living right with God, if we have God's grace, we should be enjoying God's creation as he intended. Moreover, we should be happy. What you have here is a kind of moral validation of good feeling within the Christian tradition, which begins to open things up in the succeeding centuries to get to an Enlightenment or an 18th century notion that happiness is in fact something we should be aiming for in this world.
Leap forward maybe to Rousseau. He plays a big role in your history.
Sure. Well, again, this 18th century watershed in which people begin to think of happiness is not just attainable, but really something that they can expect or should be able to expect if they're living well. Rousseau says to the 18th century, okay, you have all this talk about happiness, wonderful, but I'm not happy. And he says this, you know, in beautiful prose and kind of shrieks it to the world, and it resonates at the time. But Rousseau is enough of an 18th century thinker, enough of an Enlightenment thinker to still want happiness. And what he begins to speculate is that he's not happy and that human beings aren't happy because of the social arrangements that they live in. And that if one could imagine a more just, a more reasonable form of social organization, we could in fact make happy human beings. Mm. And I think this is at the root of what one sees in the following centuries, a type of social engineering that attempts to create happy human beings. I mean, the Marxian experiments are the best, most tragic examples of this. I always point out that Stalin actually called himself the constructor of happiness, and there are, you know, Soviet posters along these lines, and of course that somewhat ironic today.
So lots of giant projects there, no small number of which end in incredible unhappiness. I mean, the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia and right on down the list. Then there's the American experiment right in the middle of this. You say that today we treat happiness almost as a creed, that we will be happy, we should be happy, we have a right to happiness. Is that the inheritance of the founding American fathers?
Well, this is tricky. I mean, one thing I like to point out in that wonderful phrase, the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence, we usually focus on the word happiness, and rightly so, but the word pursuit is interesting too. And if you look in 18th century dictionaries, you'll find it defined as to chase or to follow in hostility, right? Pursuit becomes the act of following with hostile intention. Pursuit related to prosecute or persecute. Mm. And in fact, in Scottish law in the 18th century, a criminal prosecutor was called a pursuer. So I think there's still this knowledge in Jefferson time that the pursuit of happiness is potentially dangerous and may potentially lead us astray. But that sense slowly dissipates. Now, the other thing to point out is although Jefferson clearly says we have a right to pursue happiness, not necessarily to obtain it, that idea is floating around in the 18th century. If you read, for example, the Virginia Declaration of Rights written just the month before Jefferson's Declaration of Independence in June of 1776, written by his fellow Virginian and friend George Mason, you'll find there the line about a natural right for pursuing and obtaining happiness. And this is, in fact, also in James Madison's Bill of Rights that was originally intended to be appended to the Constitution and never was. It's not in the Constitution itself, but there are enough state constitutions floating around so that in the 19th century, people began suing state governments for not honoring their right to obtain happiness.
Because they weren't happy.
I find somewhat amusing. And so my point being that although Jefferson's own emphasis is on the right to pursue happiness, slowly and gradually, people begin to think increasingly of happiness as almost an entitlement.
Of course, Benjamin Franklin reportedly saying in response to Jefferson there, the Constitution only gives you the right to pursue happiness. You have to catch it yourself. Jack Beatty, you know how life it is. We wander around through many halls of history, even in our own time, many different concepts of happiness, no doubt alive at once with us today. How do you see the fabric of these interacting, Jack?
Well, you know, what I'm struck with reading this account is the bias in the Western mind derived from the dualism of the Greeks, body and soul, and the symbols and rites of Christianity, the bias against the body, against the unity of being, body and mind, against pleasure, against creaturely happiness. Indeed, of course, it's commonplace to observe Christianity inverts things. I mean, the moral authority comes not from happiness, a good, but from suffering. And when you think about that, what's the legacy of that in history and in life? I mean, surely much of the resignation to the world's unconscionable injustices must come from that sense, or at least be tinctured by that sense, that it is good to suffer. I deserve to suffer. And of course, this is such welcome news to the world's dictators and tyrants and authoritarians, to what St. Paul called the powers and the dominations. They love that idea that people just will accept their lot and go on. And I do think that that bias in the Western tradition, even though the Enlightenment put a parenthesis around it, by gosh, that still lives on, I think.
Jeremy McMahon, what do you say to Jack Beatty's Enlightenment view here?
Sure. And I think he sets up very nicely why it's important not to forget how important the Enlightenment was. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm a partisan of the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment did free people to think about attaining pleasure in this life in a way that had great consequence, and which is still so much a part, despite what Jack just said, I think, of our contemporary understanding. Our humanitarian efforts to relieve suffering around the world and so forth are motivated by this Enlightenment hope, although there are clearly precedents for that in the Christian tradition, too, relieving suffering of others. One thing I would point out, just to sort of complicate matters, and this is an argument I make at greater length in the book, is that even though there is this Christian notion of suffering as a way to salvation, when Christians imagine salvation, they imagine it as intense euphoria, bliss, pleasure, right? Thomas Aquinas writes about the pleasure that we will know in heaven as being beyond anything we can conceive in this world, to be like being continually drunk, right? He actually says this.
And euphoria unending.
Unending, exactly. And the argument that I make in the book is that in a strange sort of way, that Christian notion of perpetual pleasure gets brought down to earth. And so there's still a legacy of an older, not only Greek and classical, but a Judeo-Christian notion of endless pleasure, a kind of final redemption floating around in the world today, whether we acknowledge that fact or not.
It may have been imagined in the clouds, in some kind of heavenly realm, but now many people assuming that euphoria can, should, ought to be brought to earth. Let me begin to invite our listeners in. Andy is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I've had the feeling for some time, and it's related to some things that were being said a few minutes ago, but I've had the feeling for some time that the word happiness in English, as used in the 18th century, and particularly, well, as an example, as used by Jefferson,
okay,
refers to something which is less subjective and less personal, and more to something which is more objective and more social and even economic, and that the right to pursue happiness refers to the right that the government that governments would not have to present obstacles to human happiness in the economic and social sense. And this ties into what was being said about Rousseau's formulations.
So not firstly a state of mind, but a kind of objective realm of opportunity.
Something in between, but on the presumption that happiness as we think of it perhaps stems from economic and social well-being, with the word well-being being something of the meaning of well-being, mm-hmm, as we think of it today, entering into the meaning of happiness in English as used in the 18th century, supported by the ideas about Stalin being the creator of happiness and social systems creating well-being.
Let us put that to Darren McMahon, if I may, Andy, and thank you for your call. Darren, what about Jefferson's understanding of the very word and those of his contemporaries?
Absolutely. It's an important point, and it's a complicated one. I think Jefferson says famously in a letter written shortly before his death that what he was trying to do in the Declaration of Independence is get at a sort of common understanding of concepts that are part of the fabric, the social fabric of America in the 18th century. And happiness, the word would have resonated in different ways with different groups. There's a long Protestant tradition of talking about happiness and the pursuit of happiness as the pursuit of Christian virtue in the 18th century. There are these older classical legacies floating around. There's a Lockean notion of the pursuit of happiness as the pursuit of pleasure, but I think your caller is absolutely right in identifying a social component to this. Jefferson says, yes, happiness is the aim of life, but virtue is the foundation of happiness, and none of the founding fathers would have disputed that notion. And by virtue, they meant participating in a larger social realm, working for the good of others. There's a social component then to the pursuit of happiness in their understanding, as there would have been for almost all 18th century Americans. And one can argue that perhaps that again has gotten increasingly lost.
George is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, George, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I read a piece by the lugubrious voiced shelfer Visine Ben Stein a while back. And
right.
In it, he talked about the secret of happiness. And to him, the secret of happiness was to be grateful. And I can give you an example, I think, of what he means. A couple of years ago, I had a herniated disc, mm-hmm, and it was difficult, very painful for me to even stand, let alone walk. And now that I am recovered, when I remember the pain that I had, I am grateful and rejoice in the miracle of being able to be upright and to walk. And that, for a moment, gives me happiness.
So as simple as that, George, let me put it to Jack Beatty. Jack, how do you look at this? Here's the attitude of gratitude. Now, is that the kind of submission to fate that you were bemoaning earlier, or is it the key to happiness, Jack?
Well, I think there's obviously at the personal level a key to happiness, to be able to remember our time of pain and to contrast it with what we know. Relatively, we feel better. I'm just worried about that gratitude at the social level. We have many things to be grateful for, to be sure, but lots of things to complain about, and to complain about them in the name of these these ideas we got from the philosophers in the name of some more general, broader, universal idea of happiness, a democratic idea that even peasants and the poor people and the wretched of the earth deserve to be happy and not to be grateful for the little they have.
Please, sir, may I have some more? Darren McMahon, what about it? If history could look on at the United States and the clamor for happiness, the Greeks may be too far, but the Enlightenment folks, would they say, yes, that's what people should be doing. They should be demanding happiness.
I just wanted to add to your caller, I herniated my disc as well last spring when I was finishing this book, and I know his pain, and I feel a sense of gratitude that I'm back on my feet
all
now.
Right. Duly noted.
I think one thing that can be said about some of the more astute people thinking about happiness and the Enlightenment is that there is never a final endpoint, that one should continue to pursue and continue to expand, pushing, as it were, the bar higher and higher. And I think this is what Jack is alluding to, that clearly there are lots of things in life that need addressing. We can continue to try to reduce suffering, and I support that venture fully. But I also think that we forget this older wisdom that points out some of the limitations of human beings with a cost, that if we set out too boldly with too high expectations, we run the risk of falling flat.
Sarah is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Indeed, I see happiness as a very complex state of emotions for humans. However, we may look at those philosophical patterns that you just analyzed, more looking at Anglo-Saxon, probably ancient philosophies on the expression of happiness, on the maintenance of happiness. But we also have to put it into everyday perspective, culturally. I think there's a strong cultural implication to the expression of happiness in the sense that having had the opportunity as a psychotherapist dealing with American populations, as affluent as we all know that this country is, I have always been very surprised as to reasons why Americans or people with some kind of mental problems give why they want to kill themselves. And yet, being from another culture where there's such extreme poverty, many people are poor, and yet my professors and I, when even I was in school, would be saying how happy they see these African societies and Latin American societies, poor rural areas, they are so happy. So how do we put this into perspective? I think the extended family systems, a sense of community, a sense of belonging, those things are key things to our everyday expression of happiness.
Let us pick it up, Sarah, and thank you for your observation. Darren McMahon, Sarah says, look, Americans are affluent but not necessarily happy. You've got to have the extended family. I mean, Carlyle raised this. He talked about a close-knit community, purposeful labor, a sense of God. But what about the issue of relative happiness of Americans, the country devoted to the pursuit?
Yeah, not just Carlyle, but Tocqueville. I think Tocqueville is wonderful on this. You know, he comes over here for 9 months and he writes about American pursuit of happiness at great length in Democracy in America. And he makes a point similar to that of your callers. He says, you know, you go to the old world and you go to a little village where people don't have very much and they're nonetheless content, where you come here and people are restlessly pursuing happiness in everything they do, and yet they suffer from what Tocqueville called a strange melancholy. And so while I take Jack Beattie's point that we should be pushing the boundaries, again, I think the restless pursuit and self-conscious pursuit of happiness can have this paradoxical effect of making us continually dissatisfied, right? And that we need to bear that in mind.
Jack, are you willing to take on a bit of that, or does that sound like, pushing Americans back into an old world box? The ambition of happiness should be high and high-flamed.
No, I think that's right. I mean, it's the hedonic treadmill. That's the phrase Darren uses. You can't get off it. Tocqueville says that is a quality which ever retreats before them, happiness, without quite getting out of sight. And as it retreats, it beckons them on to pursue. But you know, in a strange way, that is one of the things that Americans give the world. I mean, Santayana said, our only native religion is the belief in tomorrow. And that is a gift to the world and to all those who are resigned. And that, people say it's shallow, it's cockeyed optimism. It is nevertheless a strain in the American character that goes way back. And it is one of the things we think of as part of our exceptionalism, that we're not just going to take things as they are, that we're out to make new beginnings, new births of freedom, and all the rest. And I think that is a gift that the country gives the world just by being what it's been.
Esther's calling from Malone, New York. Hi, Esther. You're on the air.
Yes. I would like to interject the thought that happiness is to know thyself and to live by the golden rule to acquire that.
Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. And is it enough to know oneself? Is it enough for you, Esther?
Yes, it has been. I feel very fulfilled because of I know myself. And therefore, I have an understanding of others that is beyond recognition by others.
By beginning right there with your own self. Dear McMahon, what about these sturdy maxims about happiness? Do you see them holding up over time? Golden rule, know thyself?
Well, yeah, I mean, Socrates lives, right? This is Socrates' goal, to know thyself and to move outward. Absolutely. I mean, I think there are a lot of truths embedded in these various traditions, even if we don't take everything wholesale anymore. There can be no doubt. If Professor Peterson were still on the phone, I think he would validate the view that, for example, those people who score highly on levels of subjective well-being, there's a correlation there with religious following. And, you know, that may strike some people as strange, but I think we're getting here at the fact that these wisdom traditions retain a good deal of wisdom that can actually help us cope with life in productive ways.
Esther, thanks for your call. Devin is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Devin. Are you feeling happy?
I'm sorry. Repeat again.
Are you feeling happy?
I'm happy to be on the show. Absolutely.
Good. Good to have you. What do you think?
I think that happiness ultimately is a choice. It's about a relationship to life's experience, so that in any given situation, challenging or otherwise, we can choose happiness, choose that perspective. Now, that's not always easy, but it's oftentimes quite simple. The other piece is to practice happiness, not simply pursue, so that, relating a little bit to this know thyself piece, is that everybody needs to come to a place where they can define what happiness is for themselves and then practice it, bring it into their lives every single day. There's an ecstatic piece here, a joyful piece here, that I think is really important. If you like walks on the beach, walk on the beach every day. If you like reading books, take time to read. We have to bring it into our daily lives.
Devin, thanks very much for that. And that's such a common outlook, or I guess happy when it is a common outlook these days. Darren McMahon, I wonder what you make of that in historical terms. Happiness as a choice. Is that,
sure,
is that into the hubris category? Would the Greeks put it there? And what about it as a practice, as a state of mind, something we can grab and hang on to if we choose to?
Sure. Well, no, I don't think it's hubris. And in fact, the comment sounds very Aristotelian. Aristotle said that if we live a life according to virtue, we can expect a happy life at the end, or in total in sum.
But I didn't hear the word virtue there necessarily, but more determination to be happy, whatever what is going on.
Right. But I think Aristotle would say that habituation, what Aristotle meant by virtue was not just, you know, doing well, but having the appropriate responses in appropriate occasions and knowing how to calibrate those accordingly and then to practice them and to cultivate them over time. So education was extremely important to Aristotle. Living in a community in which people validated certain types of behavior was important to Aristotle. And, you know, he would have probably put a little bit less emphasis on the subjective side. You know, this feels good, so I'm going to do it. But I think that the idea that happiness is something that one needs to practice, that love is something that one needs to practice, that we don't just come to it, that we need to work towards it, is very much an Aristotelian notion and has deep, deep roots in the Western tradition.
Mm. Jack Beatty, here we are 30 centuries or more after the beginning of Darren McMahon's trail, and it's coming down to practice and a choice.
A choice. I like that idea. Dr. Johnson said it's the business of a wise man to be happy. It's hard work. It's not for everybody, but you've got to go at it. And, you know, and I think part of it is just detachment, just enjoying the moment in a strange way. Rousseau speaks of the sentiment of being, that feeling of, you know, from hope and fear set free, just detachment from, you're not straining ahead, you're not fearing. That's seems to me to be the precious atoms of happiness, those moments when we're free from hope and fear.
If we're lucky enough for biology not to cut it off from us, here's Don't Worry, Be Happy. Darren McMahon, you say it almost sounds like an order these days. You've given us a more nuanced view. It's a terrific book, Happiness, a History. Darren McMahon, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Jack, thank you as well.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
It will soon pass, whatever it is.